Hey, Trey here. Two things. First, I'm not sure if you know it, but Us and Them was honored with four Associated Press Broadcasters Awards, including one for excellence in public service through journalism. Second, it's the time for the Spring Pledge Drive at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you value the work that our Us and Them team does in telling the stories about the things that divide Americans, would you consider making a pledge of support to West Virginia Public Broadcasting? You can call or text to 1-800-RADIO-87, or you can go online to WV Public and find the little red button at the upper right-hand corner. And when you pledge, let them know where you live and that you're a listener of Us and Them. Doing this would be a big help for our show and the other great programming at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And thank you so much. Hey, this is Trey. It's summer and you're on vacation, right? Or if you're like us on the Us and Them team, you're wishing you were on vacation. Actually, we're really busy coming up with some new shows for the fall. And as a matter of fact, I'm on the road right now doing some reporting. So in the meantime, we'd like to present one of our shows that we produced back in 2017 that touches on an issue that's happening all across the country in cities big and small. It's a theme similar to our recent episode, Housing in Paradise, where people on the middle or lower rungs of the economic ladder are getting priced out of decent housing. For this show, we're wondering if there can be a magic Goldilocks moment when things are not too hot or too cold or too expensive or too cheap, culturally bland or a diversity free-for-all. Are communities making room for everyone on the ladder? Here's gentrification, that kumbaya moment. So I'm walking down 8th Street in Brooklyn, right near 3rd Avenue. Some would call this neighborhood Park Slope, but it's really a hike from the beautiful Prospect Park, and it doesn't really slope very much down here. This neighborhood is actually called Gowanus, and it's very close to the infamous Gowanus Canal, which is recognized by many, many people as probably one of the most polluted bodies of water in America. And I lived in this neighborhood back in the 80s and 90s for a long, long time. Back then, this was a pretty rough part of town. My block was a mixture of row homes, not brownstones. And across the street, there was a whole bunch of warehouses. Right down the street, we had a crack house about three doors down. And one morning, I remember stepping out on my stoop on my way to work, and I looked down, and there was a man sprawled out amongst our garbage cans, and he was sticking a needle in his arm. And in the years when I lived here, in an open lot somewhere over there, they found a decapitated head. But looking around the neighborhood today, it's hard to imagine any of that going on. I mean, the place still has a dingy industrial look, and the canal is still filthy. But there's this upbeat vitality that's unavoidable. I mean, it seems hipper and wealthier. The streets are a lot cleaner. There's cool art spaces and a burgeoning underground entertainment scene. You used to have to walk a long way to find a place to eat. Now there are these little Tony alfresco restaurants with people sitting outside sipping wine and latte. And there seems to be a lot of young, single hipsters. And overall, it seems a lot whiter than it did back then. And I can see how this might create a divide. On one side, you have newcomers, people who came here to open a business or live in a trendy neighborhood. And on the other side, you have the old guard, the people who grew up here before it was trendy. And they've been watching the place that they call home rapidly transform all around them. In other words, it's tempting to think of gentrification as a clear-cut case of us and them. But as we're going to hear in today's episode, the evolution of a neighborhood is anything but simple. When I think of what's happened here in Brooklyn over the last decade, I can't help but believe there must have been a golden period maybe a few months, maybe a couple of years, between the neighborhood I knew in the 1980s and 90s and the neighborhood of today. I'm talking about a sort of kumbaya moment when crime was going down, property values were going up, when people were helping make the neighborhood more diverse and creative and neighborly. But before the cost of living skyrocketed and longtime residents started to leave, what I want to know is there a way to preserve that kumbaya moment? From West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX, this is Us and Them, the podcast where we tell stories from America's culture divides. I'm Trey Kay. As this Us and Them podcast finds its way into more and more people's ears, something pretty cool has started to happen. Occasionally, someone who listens to the show reaches out to me with an idea. Jake Jerome Smith, a radio producer in Chicago, wrote to me a while back and he sent me this piece that he produced, and it's a story that really got me thinking. It captured this sort of bizarre conversation that he had with his neighbor Mike about their neighborhood. Let's listen to Jake's piece right now.
My neighbor Mike remembers the very first time we met, maybe 6 months ago.
If you remember the very first conversation that I had with you, I said, wow, you guys are really quiet. Because I never really saw anybody hanging out.
I was coming home from work and he was outside of his apartment. We talked for maybe 5 minutes. I checked the mail. I went inside.
And even now, I never see you guys there.
And to this day, he's one of the only people on my block whose name I even know. Mike and I have only met a couple of times, so he's surprised this afternoon when I leave a note on his front door.
Hey, Mike, Jake from next door. Could you give me a call?
The number is 3... He calls me back within an hour. We head to a Mexican restaurant a couple blocks away and start talking.
Señora, ¿cómo está? Can I get you anything?
I plan to ask him how the neighborhood has changed over time. After all, I've lived here less than a year while he bought his property in 1980.
For $31,500.
It was a dangerous part of town, says Mike.
There was shooting, there was prostitution.
Once that changed, developers started scooping up cheap properties.
Early 90s.
Soon the neighborhood was a hub for Central American families. And then young urban professionals started to trickle in.
So.
And before long.
Gentrification for me is.
There it is. Finally, the word we've been skirting around, the subtext of our entire conversation, gentrification. The fact is, I'm a white guy who moved into a Latino neighborhood to be close to my mostly white friends. And as often as not, we and our roommates are replacing Latino families who have been here for decades, families not unlike Mike's.
Yeah, how do you feel about that change?
I love it. I absolutely love it. Because my property values keep going up. Young people bring new ideas, and they've revitalized Logan Square.
Which isn't what I expect to hear. Mike isn't worried about affordable housing. He doesn't feel Latino culture is being threatened. But a lot of people do. I start making the case that by living here and supporting businesses that cater to people like me, I am driving people out. I am part of the...
You gotta be kidding me. How can you feel like you're part of the social problem? If you were selling drugs or you were running a prostitution ring, absolutely, yes, you are part of a problem. But being Caucasian, moving into Logan Square, I mean, this is the area that people your age are moving to. I mean, why would you even care what they have to say about
it? It's not that it's about me. It's that I want to be a good neighbor, that I don't want to be, you know, if they're like, oh, there's that gringo jerk who's, you know, moved into, who moved
the... If you want to be a good neighbor, the first step is communication. If you want to be a good neighbor and you want them to say, this is not the gringo that we think he is, you make it a point to say hello or...
No, I do. I just give a wave or a head nod or something if someone's out on their porch. I do.
You never did that to me. I used to see all the time. You were counting the sidewalk squares.
Really?
Yeah. I'm the one who struck up the conversation. Yep. And it was like this whole shield just kind of dropped.
It's something that never occurred to me. That I convinced myself that my neighbors must hate people like me. And so I put up a shield. And so the damage of gentrification becomes personal.
By not communicating, kind of gives them the perception that maybe you feel superior to them. And I have not heard that. But that's kind of how you know, they might feel.
Later in the evening, I take a walk. And I feel like I'm part of the problem. Not just because I'm white, not just because I'm privileged, but because I've lived here for nearly a year. And every person I pass is still a stranger.
Jake sent me this story about him and his neighbor, Mike, several months ago, and it was the inspiration for today's program. I was curious to hear how things might have changed between Jake and his neighbor since he produced this piece, so I invited him onto the podcast to tell us more. Hey, Jake.
Hey, Trey.
So have you had a chance to check in with your neighbor, Mike?
Yeah, so after I finished the story, I sent it to Mike, and when he heard it, he actually kind of felt bad. He said it brought back memories of when he first moved into the neighborhood in the 80s, back when the block was mainly older Polish people.
They were intimidated by the Hispanics moving in, but over time, I was able to get beyond that barrier that they had put up or their perception of Hispanics. The one lady that owned this brownstone, she's a very dear friend of mine. And again, you know, she was very afraid when, you know, we first moved in here. She thought that we were going to break into her home, that we were going to rob her.
So Mike was just glad that I trusted him enough to have a conversation. And since then, I've been trying hard to say hi to everybody and be a good neighbor. Mike and I have had a lot more conversations, and they often end up going back to this same topic. But his position on gentrification has not changed.
Logan Square has, I mean, all of Chicago has always been a melting pot, and it continues to evolve that way. And you either accept it or you don't.
Hey, Jake, I really appreciate you sharing your piece with us. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Trey.
In a way, Jake's neighbor Mike is right. All neighborhoods are perpetually changing. So what makes gentrification gentrification?
When I use that term, I feel like I'm not sure what people are understanding.
Ingrid Gould Ellen is a professor of urban policy at New York University. Her research focuses on housing and particularly how it relates to segregation and health outcomes. She says that whenever possible, she tries to avoid the word gentrification because everyone has their own definition.
To some people, it is fairly simply the in-movement of higher income households into lower income city neighborhoods. For other peoples, it has many, many more connotations, and including the displacement of existing poor residents.
This might be part of why Jake and Mike can't agree on what gentrification is doing to their neighborhood. They're looking at different sides of the same coin. But Professor Ellen says both of those sides do deserve to be seriously considered.
There's a part of me that wants to embrace the fact that we now have educated white middle-class households making choices to move into low-income neighborhoods and cities. And I see there's potentially some hope there that this could help to break down the kind of racial concentration and the poverty concentration that we've seen in our cities for decades. At the same time, that in movement might also increase rents and ultimately could lead to a resegregation of those neighborhoods.
The question is it possible to get the good without the bad? In New Orleans, just northeast of the French Quarter, there's a neighborhood called Saint Roch. For the last part of the 20th century, St. Roch has been mostly a black, lower-income area.
I remember it being fun. I mean, I was a teenager, so everything was probably fun at the time.
That's Troy Glover. He was living in St. Roch in the early 2000s.
I remember having a lot of family around. I remember having a lot of crime and poverty as well.
Troy himself had something of a rough childhood. His dad was killed when Troy was just 1 year old, and his mom struggled with drug and alcohol addiction. So as a kid, Troy moved around the city a lot. He was a teenager by the time he went to live with an older cousin in St. Roch. It was one of the first places that really felt like home. But then, in 2005, Hurricane Katrina hit. Troy remembers flood water coming up to his neck. After the storm, his home and neighborhood were no longer livable. So after 5 days at the Superdome, Troy and his family got on a bus and headed to Texas, where they lived for several years.
I missed being in New Orleans. I missed crawfish and po' boys. And so my goal was to graduate from my high school, because in New Orleans, high schools are huge. Instead of asking what college you go to, we ask what high school you went to. And so I was adamant about graduating from McDonald's 35. So I moved back in 2008 by myself.
How did the neighborhood change when you first came back? I mean, was that clearly noticeable? You'd been gone away for 2 or 3 years. What was it like when you got back?
So before Katrina, I didn't really interact with outside races because there just weren't many people who were non-blacks in the community. But after Katrina, when I came back, there was a bit more diversity.
Well, how did you feel about that?
So when I came back, initially, I was a bit apprehensive about building relationships with new people, because I mean, you don't know people and you're afraid of what you don't know. But I always tell a story about Aaron Collier. He's an elder at the church that I go to. And we used to play at the basketball court when I came back. And Aaron used to always come to the basketball court and shoot around with us. And it was probably the first time I had ever played basketball with a white person. And so we used to intentionally foul Aaron like super hard, like just to see what he would do and how tough he actually was. And after one day of playing, we decided that he's definitely not coming back. And like the next day he came back and he played basketball some more with us. And we continued to foul him hard for a while. But after that, we continued to build a relationship, and soon he eventually invited us to his home for dinner. And we probably said no the first 5 times, but after building more relationships, I eventually went over myself and some friends. And now AC is Aaron is one of my closest friends.
I love that story. So why do you think that you felt the need to foul this guy? I mean, just cause he was different, or it was like a rite of passage, or were you just trying to maybe hope that he would leave the neighborhood because you didn't like the white guys around?
I mean, I would say a combination of all those things.
And Aaron wasn't the only white person on the block. In the 2 years when Troy was in Texas, New Orleans had been inundated with people from all over the country, people who wanted to help the city rebuild.
The first crop of people, the initial transplants that moved to New Orleans, came with a genuine concern for the city.
But something changed, right?
Yes and no. There were people who moved in, and there are still people who move in who have a sincere care and love for the neighborhood, the culture, and the city. But there are also people who move in who see that something as simple as sitting on your porch and speaking to your neighbors is part of the culture of New Orleans. And they don't speak. They don't sit on their porches. They
Troy, did you have any confrontations with anybody in the neighborhood, any of the new people? Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I mean, I've had times where I've spoken to people and I didn't receive any acknowledgement of being spoken to back. I was just having an open conversation. Hey, you're buying this house. A good friend of mine used to stay here, you know, and they didn't care and said to me that they was buying the house to make money.
In the years following Katrina, there was also money to be made in redevelopment. At the southern tip of St. Rock, just a few blocks from the mighty Mississippi River, there's this huge 8,600 square foot building from the 1870s. It's called the St. Rock Market. And before Katrina, there were vendors there who sold groceries and fresh fish and some of the best gumbo and po' boys in town. It was sort of a neighborhood gathering spot. It was cheap. But like most of St. Rock, the market was badly flooded after Katrina. And for several years, this once vibrant building sat empty, boarded up, and collecting graffiti. But around 2010, it looked like that was about to change. The city had promised to refurbish the building. And community surveys found that a majority of the neighborhood pretty much wanted the old market back, with vendors selling fresh fruit, vegetables, and seafood, maybe a restaurant. But it wasn't unanimous. Other people wanted a high-end grocery store or a wine shop. In the end, it was up to city council to decide which businesses would get a spot there. The new market opened on April 10th, 2015. New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu spoke at the grand opening ceremony.
So This is your community center. This is your neighborhood. This is to build this neighborhood back in a way that gives us an opportunity to give folks in New Orleans a great place to live, to work, and play. And of course, the new New Orleans way, and this is the only way it works, is for everybody to be at the table. Federal, state, local government.
So if you went in there to get a cup of coffee before Katrina.
I don't think they sold coffee in the market before Katrina. They sell it now, though.
Well, what's a cup of coffee cost?
Probably $4 to $5.
Wow. Coming up, we'll hear Troy calling out a fellow church member for gentrifying his neighborhood. I'm Trey Kay, and this is Us and Them, which is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation.
In difficult times, music gives us peace, brings us together, and helps heal us. It calms our nerves and brightens our days. That's why we're bringing you classic episodes of Mountain Stage on air and in our podcast. This is Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Find something that's familiar or brand new and feel the power of live music on our website, mountainstage.org.
So before the break, we heard New Orleans resident Troy Glover tell us that a cup of coffee at the St. Rock Market costs around $4 to $5. Now, to be accurate, a cup of drip coffee there costs $2.35, and the fancier drinks slope upward to around the $4 to $5 range, which is pretty much like coffee shops all around the country. Regardless, some of the neighbors were really upset about what the market had become. I mean, if you check out their website, it's a pretty tony, upscale-looking place. The shops there no longer accept food stamps, which made it impossible for lower-income residents to shop or feed their families there. And then, just a couple weeks after the market reopened,
some people decided to share their frustrations and vandalize the market.
Vendors arrived this morning to broken glass and graffiti.
The recently reopened New Orleans Landmark was covered in graffiti spelling out blank yuppies and yuppie equals bad. More than
a dozen. And then a number of the windows were smashed in.
That's John Arp. He and his wife had just moved into St. Rock when the vandalism happened. And John could tell right away that this vandalism was just a symptom of a much deeper problem.
I could see it in other folks when a young 20-something hipster-ish person walked down the street and didn't even look up. You just get a sense of like, oh, that versus this, there's definitely a tension here. And I don't think either of these two groups of people are really talking to one another right now.
John had come to St. Rock to spend the summer working with the St. Rock Community Church, where Troy was a member. If anything was going to help St. Rock achieve a true kumbaya moment, it was going to be the St. Rock Community Church. As new people moved into the neighborhood, this church always made a point to welcome them. As a result, the church developed a really diverse congregation, and it had a really great reputation for bringing people together as a community. But it was starting to tear apart. About a month after the vandalism, the Times-Picayune newspaper published an article about gentrification in St. Rock. The article quoted people from the church, including Troy, who said that St. Rock might not exist in 5 years because of this market and because of people like John.
A lot of the people, especially the white members of this church who hadn't been there as long, it was just sort of like, what are we supposed to do?
This was kind of a shock for this close-knit community, and they wanted to face it head on.
Yeah, so myself and a good friend of mine, we hosted a conversation panel thingy to talk about the new market.
35 or 40 members of this church all came and just sat at someone's house who lived right across the street. And it was sort of a moderated conversation between two of the members.
It was high passion and emotion, and people expressed the way they felt.
It was heartening to see a group of people who disagreed and loved each other so passionately. And so the kind of project that we ended up doing over the rest of the summer was shaped a lot by that conversation that afternoon.
John is an artist and a documentarian. He had come to St. Rock hoping to maybe create some kind of exhibit about the church community here, to look at the unique ways they were dealing with their changing neighborhood. And this meeting is where that vague idea began to crystallize.
on the most concrete level, the project was basically a series of 10 or 11 audio conversations that were recorded throughout the summer.
Did you come up with the questions, or did you just turn the microphone and say, okay, guys, talk?
It really depended on who was there. I had, after doing the first one, which was Andrew and Mr. Pershing, and Mr. Pershing basically just defines what New Orleans sounds like.
So what are you trying to do to my neighborhood? Trying to put us out? Is this what you're trying to do, put us out? No, we cannot allow that.
And it kind of went off topic quite a bit. So I ended up printing 10 questions. You know, what does gentrification mean to you? Or how long have you been in this neighborhood? You think this neighborhood is getting better or getting worse, you know? And then some of the more unique stuff was just when they were really engaged in asking each other questions that weren't on the sheet.
Well, to that end, was there anything that just really surprised you?
I think one of my favorite quotes from the whole thing from Ms. Velma was,
I think gentrification in this area here is off the chain. I really
do. So this is good. Off the chain is good.
Yeah, yeah. Off the chain. Like, gentrification is off the chain. Like, she was excited about it, really. This is not something I was expecting to hear from someone who's been in this neighborhood for a long time. But as she explained it, it's like she, you know, was dealing with gun violence. A lot of that stuff was going on. And so she's seen a lot of the positive changes. And that's, it was just a good reminder not to think that it's going to be real straightforward and very black and white, and it's always going to be gray. It's never going to be super clear.
John knew that Troy would make a good interview, so they wanted to find just the right person for him to talk to.
I wasn't the one who was originally supposed to have the conversation with him, but whoever it was had to cancel, and so John just kind of asked me after church that day if I would be interested in having the conversation, and I said sure.
Originally from West Virginia, Julie Whiteman moved to St. Rock in 2008 to help rebuild, which meant that she was one of the early newcomers and had been living in St. Rock for 7 years at this time. Julie was really active in the church, and she and Troy were great friends. But at the same time, Julie is white, which means that she looked a lot like the people who were changing Troy's neighborhood. And once John started recording, it didn't take long for that tension to come out. This is the audio from that interview.
Do you think that you are helping to further gentrification?
I don't know. I think that the house that I live in and the people that live in it are all dedicated to sharing the love of Christ in a way that's gonna hopefully lift people up into a place that's better than where they are. And I think everybody in my house is dedicated to that, so I don't feel like we're a part of this.
But y'all are white and not from New Orleans.
Right. But
in case she didn't catch that, Troy is bluntly reminding Julie that she and her roommates are white and not from New Orleans. And it's not the only time he calls her out.
So would you move out your house if there was a black family from New Orleans that was looking for somewhere to stay?
I don't think that's what we're talking about.
I'm asking.
Possibly. Whatever the Lord says. If God came down and told me that there was a black family that needed to move into my house and
that's
he needed
from New
me
Orleans.
To move out, that's from New Orleans, I'd be gone.
All right.
That's a doozy. I mean, I think that, again, is Troy being very direct. And, I mean, trying to see how Julie would react. I mean, they have a great friendship and relationship. This wasn't two people that didn't know each other or were just trying to like push each other's buttons. I think he was genuinely probably curious how she would react to some of these questions.
I'm used to Troy asking me crazy questions. It's not a crazy question. It's a legitimate question. But you know what I mean? I'm used to Troy asking me difficult questions.
I asked that question because I know that me and Julie have built a relationship, and we're at a point where we can ask honest and open and transparent questions.
That's what impresses me so much about John's project and about this church. Troy and Julie were able to be so honest with one another and to have this conversation that seems so incredibly awkward and difficult because they were such good friends. And it wasn't just Troy and Julie. In several of the other conversations John recorded, you can hear the neighbors being unusually candid about their feelings.
you walk past someone, it's not like you're going to say, hello, how do you feel about gentrification? But I think taking the time to sit down and have pointed conversation on this topic, every single person that did it felt really good about it afterwards. Like, oh, I didn't actually know you came for this reason, or you'd been here for this long, or you used to live in this neighborhood, or here's how you think about X, Y, and Z.
It's fair to say that John's summer project succeeded at getting people to talk with one another. It really made the community feel like a community. So in a way, you might say that he achieved something like a kumbaya moment. But remember what Ingrid Ellen, the NYU professor, was saying earlier about how no one agrees exactly what gentrification is. For some people, the main challenge raised by gentrification is simply how well are the old timers and the newcomers getting along? Are people talking, getting to know one another? Or are they living side by side in silence and mistrust? John's project definitely did help address that dynamic by getting people to talk face to face. But of course, for people who worry about gentrification, that's not the only concern. In fact, it's not even the main concern. The main concern is that people, especially poorer people, are being priced out of their homes.
Julie, do you ever feel that you're a part of a movement that is pushing people out?
That's the question. That's the tense question. And honestly, I don't know. I know that I look like the people that are pushing people out, but I know that I don't act like the people that are pushing people out. So I don't really know how to answer that question.
It turns out this question is actually more complicated than it seems. Ingrid Ellen, the NYU professor, actually did a study to find out how frequently people are being pushed out of their homes by gentrification.
Yeah, basically we found that there was sort of no evidence of elevated rates of departure from among even sort of the vulnerable low-income residents in gentrifying neighborhoods, okay? But let me be clear, we also did see that those residents were paying higher rents as when they lived in gentrifying neighborhoods. So they were paying more, and so they may have been struggling in many ways, but we didn't see evidence of direct displacement.
Professor Ellen makes clear that her research only looked at the 1990s, and that things obviously have changed since then. But still, the fact that Ellen found this is really striking and goes against what a lot of people assume. Of course, not everybody buys her findings.
I would love to know what community she's talking about. When I walk down a block and see license plates and none of them say Louisiana, I think that's a problem.
Why is that a problem?
Because originally most of them said Louisiana. So the next question would be, where are those Louisiana plates? And why aren't they able to come back?
Whether we're talking about New York or New Orleans or Chicago, is this just the way things go? Is this just the cost of progress?
So I think that there is a little bit of a catch-22, that all of these cities, I think, have experienced something of a rebirth. I think they are attracting families and households, individuals who might not have chosen to live in cities a few decades ago. But the sort of dark side of that happy story is that prices and rents are going up.
It feels like there would be some type of golden age in the economic cycle where that kumbaya moment can exist. Is there any way of maintaining that?
Yeah. So when you get to that moment, a lot of people are feeling unbelievable levels of anxiety about their ability to remain in the neighborhood. So I'm not sure everybody's feeling the kumbaya, right? I'm not sure that's going to happen on its own, but I think with deliberate policy and thoughtful policy intervention, it can.
Professor Ellen told me about Chelsea, a neighborhood in New York City. It's one of the city's fastest growing, most expensive areas. But it also has two public housing developments, with some 2,000 apartments in total. And Ellen reminded me about the community center in Chelsea. It's called the Hudson Guild, that tries to make sure that those public housing residents feel like they're not being pushed out. She thinks it's a good model for other gentrifying neighborhoods.
community groups can help residents connect to new opportunities. They can talk to local businesses about hiring local residents. They can help to educate and provide critical services to the low-income families who, you know, remain in gentrifying neighborhoods and often felt left behind.
Now, to be clear, plenty of really smart people disagree with what Ellen is saying. First of all, a lot of new research has come out to some very different conclusions. A recent study out of Princeton found that the poorest people in gentrifying neighborhoods were most likely to end up moving out and to worse neighborhoods. So not only was there an impact, but it hit the most vulnerable people the hardest. Another scholar out of Berkeley told me that while Ellen's story about Chelsea is nice, examples of wealthy people looking out for their poorer neighbors are actually few and far between. So what does this mean for St. Rock? Are people being pushed out of the neighborhood as much as Troy thinks? And if so, can a group like the St. Rock Community Church actually do anything to fight it? As far as the research goes, we don't really have any clear answers. In all likelihood, we'll just have to wait and see what happens. But I'm not despairing for St. Rock just yet. This is from a kid's summer camp at St. Rock Community Church a few years ago. In the video, you see 24 elementary school kids. Most are black, but two are white, and they're all dressed in matching yellow shirts and singing together. It's not Kumbaya, it's a Christian song called Call Me and I Will Answer You. The video makes me wonder, what will happen to these kids in a decade? When they grow up and have to decide whether to stay in St. Rock, what they want their neighborhood to look like, and what kind of neighbors they'll be. Finding and preserving the Kumbaya moment takes a community that cares about making sure no one is left behind. It takes community groups that stick up for the marginalized members. But as I watch this group of kids clap and sing and dance along together, it seems to me, as long as there are groups like the St. Rock Community Church that don't just sing and dance together, but genuinely advocate for their most vulnerable members, well, maybe a Kumbaya moment isn't totally out of the question. You've been listening to Us and Them. This show was produced by Jake Smith and me, Trey Kay, and was edited by Cousin B and mixed by Mitch Hanley. Joni Deutsch is our digital producer. Special thanks to John Bewin of Duke University's Center for Documentary Studies and host of the wonderful Scene on Radio podcast. He let us know about John Arp and his project of collecting stories in the St. Rock neighborhood of New Orleans. If you'd like to hear more of the people that John Arp interviewed and see some of the fantastic photos that his wife Gabriella shot of these people, we've posted a link at our website at usandthempodcast.com. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them show music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. Rita Krasoffi and Mariana Trofimova designed our website at usandthempodcast.com and provide us with images for the web. Our intern is Nicholas Tantillo. The marvelous people at PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the West Virginia Humanities Council, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation. Us and Them was originally developed with assistance from the mentorship program at AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio. We'll see you next time on Us and Them.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From PRX.